Someone sent me an email saying they enjoy watching my videos, especially when they are feeling low or they are bored. When you're not bored, no point in watching. Can we have the AC cooler? So the main question was that he resonates with the teaching so much, but he still can't accept that God could create terrorism, brutality, Hitler. How could God be so evil? Which is a very common question which comes up. You need to... Yeah, it's a bit warm.
Okay.
Or maybe you can switch that on as well. That AC on the other wall. See, we look at God as an individual, whereas God is the source, the totality. If there is good and there is evil, does it mean that the good has come from God and the evil has come from the devil? Because if that is so, then who created God and who created the devil? So Advaita, which means not two, means all there is the source. And the design of life, the basic structure and matrix of life, is duality. Now supposing we all were born with one hand coming out from the middle of our chest. Is there any question of a left hand and a right hand? So the design of life is interconnected opposites. Left and right, up and down, front and back, black and white, pleasure and pain. That is the nature of manifestation. Interconnected opposites of every conceivable kind. But what happens is we say, how could God be so cruel? How could he create handicapped children? What harm have they done? And God would ask, but then why don't you ask me why I created healthy children? Yet, we all feel that yes, how can God create terrorism, murders, brutality? Because in some instances, the ego with its sense of doership has got completely disconnected from the source. That is why these happen. Our nature is love. We do not have to do anything to be loving. Now, as we all know, in the kitchen, it is the same electricity which is functioning through all the gadgets, the microwave, the toaster, the juicer, whatever you name it. Each gadget designed to produce precisely what it is supposed to produce, because the toaster cannot make juice. Now, what animates these gadgets is electricity. Without electricity, they are dead objects in the kitchen. It is the same electricity functioning through all the gadgets. Each gadget designed to produce what it is producing. Now, with this understanding that it is the same consciousness functioning through all of us. If one lived that understanding, can one harm another? Can electricity harm electricity? Can consciousness harm consciousness? Therefore, as the masters say, the nature of consciousness is love. By nature, your being itself, the I am, the pure sense of presence and being, is love. Because in that pure sense and presence of being, everything is accepted. And that is what is recognized in the other. The vision has shifted from individuals and our judgments of them to a witnessing that everyone is designed by the same source. Everyone, just like me, has had a bombardment of conditioning from the time they were born. What their parents told them, how their siblings treated them, whether they were bullied in school or not, which religion they belonged to. Everyone has received different sets of conditioning like I have. So if I find flaws in others, it is proof that I too have my own flaws, because we are precisely the way we have been made. When this understanding is lived, one develops an even vision. The labeling stops, the judgments stop, the arguments stop, opinions of how others should be drop away. Wanting to change others drops away. Now, isn't this love? Or is love only for a select few who are close to me? Doesn't the sage accept each and every person who comes to him the way they are? Precisely the way God created them. Because the sage is not seeing them as individuals. Now, even the terrorist cannot not love. Because what is love? What are you trying to protect? Your sense of being. You are trying to protect your sense of being. I am. I exist. I must protect it. That is also coming out of love only. What has happened is it has got projected onto the other when the other is perceived as a threat to me, to my existence. That is when the ego with a sense of doership has kicked in. But everything begins and ends with love. The motive is love. That is why Nisargadatta Maharaj says, I don't want you to love anyone. Just don't harm anyone. Not simple. Because we tend to harm by words, by thoughts, because of fear. And this is what the spiritual journey is about. Unraveling this. Allowing the light to shine. There is nothing to be acquired. But what has been encrusted, overlaid through years of conditioning, of separation, of ill will, jealousy, envy, hatred, malice, blame, condemnation of others and myself. That encrusted conditioning with this understanding starts dropping away. I was asked yesterday in an audio interview that what tool can one use or what tool can you suggest to live with this teaching? And the beauty of this teaching is there is no tool. The understanding itself is the tool. And it is simple. But it's too simple, so then we want tools. I read on the internet a quotation by a poet. The truth is simple. If it was complicated, then everyone would get it. The mind loves it. But it is so simple. As Siddha Rameshwar Maharaj said, that if you call someone a thief, that word thief is appearing only in your consciousness, not outside your consciousness. So that vibration and word thief is appearing within yourself and has got nothing to do with the other. What are the words which we think we are calling others and labeling others become the vibrations in our own consciousness, especially the people we don't like. That is why the people we don't like are our greatest teachers. But one needs humility to accept that. It doesn't mean being walked over. It doesn't mean taking nonsense. But understanding that just like you, they are an instrument of the divine. That is why Krishna has said, if you see me in everyone, nothing more needs to be done. Can it be simpler? In the Christian tradition, consciousness is equated with light. Let there be light. And the nature of light is to shine. The nature of consciousness is to shine. It cannot not shine. So everyone is a being of light. It cannot be otherwise. Because otherwise you'd be dead. That is why Aurobindo says that when you are giving a gift to someone on their birthday, instead of offering it to the individual, you should be offering it in awareness to the divine in that individual, not to the me, not to the limited me and the body, which means to offer a gift to another is to offer the gift to yourself. Consciousness is offering gift to consciousness. That is love. Isn't that true love? And the more you rest in being, the more you start disengaging from your story, the story of me, the aggressive thinking mind, working overtime all the time, creating imaginary situations, constantly referring to the dead past, this happened to me, that happened to me, or the imaginary future, this might happen to me, that might happen to me. The obsession of the me with me starts dropping away when you accept that whatever happens is God's will. The obsession with defending the me starts dropping away when you realize everyone is an instrument of the divine like I am. And when the obsession with the me starts dropping away, the presence of presence which was always there is allowed to shine, pure being. That is why Nisargadatta Maharaja said, your birth is not the time of conception. Did you know that you were born? Nobody knows their birth. But the birth of the sense of being is the actual birth. Because a baby up to the age of a year and a half or so does not even have that sense of being. When it starts learning that if I cry, my mother comes, the awareness kicks in. Otherwise, the baby does not have that I am awareness. The I am is the birth of being, and then the ego starts developing, the separate me. And then that separate me starts becoming more and more separate as time goes on. Up to a certain age, the baby doesn't know who its parents are. Then it is told, I am your mother, I am your father. I am your mother as apart from you. So what this understanding does is pushes you back into being, because you've been becoming for too long. It pushes you gently back into your natural state. All your projections onto people, what you want them to think about you, all that drama of the me, to protect the me, to safeguard the me, to project a certain image, wear a certain mask, it starts clearing all that away. Then you are naturally who you are. And that is, Ramakrishna said something so beautiful. He said, when the flower blooms, the bees come. The bees will come on their own. One doesn't have to do anything. When you bloom, whoever is meant to come your way, new friendships, new relationships, we don't know. But then what is meant to happen will happen. Because when one rests in being, others sense that. They get drawn to it. Words cannot explain it, because words take one away from it. Now I'll share with you all some things. On our floor, there are many flats in this building. On each floor, there's a lady must be somewhere between 70 and 80. You have to pass by her door to come here. For the last 30 years, maybe more, she has been nasty to the building staff. She's a single lady, a spinster, and she has been a nuisance. Treats them like dirt. Doesn't treat her neighbors well. Always complaining. Always running to the police station or the BMC to file complaints about anyone and everyone. Non-stop. Didn't work. This was her pastime. To create trouble. The drivers of the building in the summer months just put up a small shade to escape the heat. Went and complained to the BMC. This has to be removed. Small things like this. Not about rules being flouted openly, just any small triggers. And of course, we being neighbors also were the target of such unfortunate situations, but one has to deal with it. 4 days ago, she was sitting outside her door on the floor. So I asked the building watchman, what has happened? Is she unwell? So the watchman said, we don't know, but we think she's lost her mind. Now the same watchman, the same guards who were abused by her, go and give her tea, give her coconut water. And the same person who was so nasty has changed overnight into someone very gentle, full of fear. There's a window which overlooks our kitchen. So it used to be closed because we have girls working in the kitchen and people from outside can look in. So all these years that window was closed. But about 6 months ago, she insisted that that window be kept open so that air can reach her flat, which has all closed windows. But there was no point arguing. You see, because what was happening was we were keeping the window open, she was closing it. And then she started screaming and shouting at us. So I told my family, let's find a solution. There's no point getting drawn into this too much. So we got a cloth put up to, let's say, the head of the maids. The maids are not too tall. So a nice kind of screen we created at our kitchen window so others cannot look in, right? And I said, let it be now. There's no point every day having this argument on open and closed windows. Do you know that since 4 days, she has been closing that window. So what does this mean? It means people are not nasty by choice. I don't know how her mother treated her. My mother tells me her mother was equally bad with the staff of the building. Not nasty by choice and not nice by choice. Something happens, situations are created, and our nature, which is a combination of our genetics and conditioning, is the outcome. And the outcome, nobody ever knows. Could she ever dream? Could I dream that I would be having a conversation with her? It could not happen in the past. Then I went up to her. She was sitting like this on her chair. I said, "Can we do something for you?" She said, "No, it's all right." Not even those words were spoken nicely for the last 30 years. I said, "Do you have a relation?" "No relation." "Can we get someone from the church you visit to come because they can help you?" "I don't know anyone in the church." We have not had this much of a conversation over the last 30 years, and now it is happening. Who created these circumstances? Did she create them? Did we create them? Did the gods create them? Or was it a happening which happened? What the next moment brings, you never know. Sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain. Real life situation. That is why Shirdi Sai Baba has said in the Sai Baba charters and sayings that, please, whatever it may be, don't be too hard on your enemies, because they are an aspect of me. So don't be too hard on the people you don't like in your lives. The reason you are being hard on them is because actually you love them and you love yourself. You're trying to protect yourself. And don't be too hard on yourself. Why am I like this? Why has God made me fearful? Why has God made me this way and that way? That is the way you think God should have made you. God has not placed any such demands. I saw a Calvin and Hobbes cartoon where I think Calvin tells Hobbes, life is hard. And Hobbes replies, compared to what? You can only say life is hard in the waking state. Anyone wants to share anything?
You're talking about life being hard. Is this an analogy of
a... That's recorded.
Life being hard, or talking about impediments. And there's an analogy of the river. The river flows, and as it flows, it nurtures every kind of being, every form of being, from trees to plants to insects. And then suddenly in the middle of this river, there's this huge boulder. And what we do as human beings is we stop there and we say, but why does the river do that? Stop and say, but why are you in my way? And what one doesn't know as a human being is that that is the way. When it meanders around that rock, that is the way. And the boulder is not in the way. It is the way. And in fact, the river, the water as it flows over the rock, slowly actually softens it. And then ultimate destination is the sea, which is death, which doesn't refuse anyone. So we're talking about impediments and how life is hard, but it is like you said, our interpretation of hard compared to something. Which...
Yeah, and like you said, the destiny of the river is to merge with the ocean. Ultimately, we are all going home. Ultimately, we are all going home. That boulder might be there so that you go home faster. You never know. We don't know because we don't have the full vision. We have a segmented vision, a split vision. What we have done is that entire loaf of bread, we have just pulled out one slice to eat. We don't know what the rest of the bread looks like. And so our entire life is sliced. We have created time slices. And we are living slice by slice by slice by slice. And coming back to the river, what we don't understand is that the banks of the river are pleasure and pain. Can there be only one bank? Can a river have only one bank? Can your life be only pleasure, 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 and there's no other bank? Is that possible? And that is why Maharaj said, between the banks of pleasure and pain, my life flows. Because that is life. And in a place like India, we can reach home faster. Because this is the land of spirituality and chaos. When Eckhart was here in 2002, and we had gone first to Thiruvannamalai, and then he came to Bombay for a talk, and the Bombay traffic was as bad and chaotic as it is today. And in the car he told me, no wonder they are more enlightened people in India. Did you hear the joke about the man who was in search of how to connect to God the fastest? So he was in some European country and he entered a church and he asked the priest, and the priest pointed in the corner and he said, that's a telephone to God. So he walked up to the telephone and it was gold in color, bright shining, and it said, phone call to God, 100,000 euros. So he said, my God. So he asked the priest, 100,000 euros? He said, but it's a direct line to God. I mean, is price an issue here? So he said, no, no, you're right. So he was quite taken aback. So then he went to a Buddhist country, went to a monastery, and he asked the monk there, I want a direct connection to God. So the monk said, you go in that corner. Again he saw a golden telephone. And again he saw some 500,000 whatever dollars or whatever, and he said, what is this? Why is it so expensive to contact God directly? So the monk said, but it's a direct line. Who else has offered you this? So he was quite disheartened, but he was amazed at the coincidence. Like this, he went to different countries and he kept seeing this golden phone in the corner and a huge price. So then he was completely frustrated and his friends told him, look, I think you need to go to India. So he came to India and he said, okay, I'll go into a temple. He went into the temple and he saw the same golden phone. He said, my God. So he went up close to the phone and he saw, and it said 1 rupee. So he was shocked. He said, wow, this is amazing. So he went and asked the temple priest. He said, sir, all over the world I've traveled, it's $100,000, this many euros, why is it only 1 rupee? And the priest said, beta, because in India it is a local call.
So the essence is so simple, it's just 1 rupee away.
It's just?
1 rupee away.
Yeah.
In India.
Buddha said about that simplicity of Advaita. There's a very nice quote.
Read it out, no?
It says, to understand nothing takes time.
Hmm.
It's a Zen proverb. It's very similar to what you said.
Yeah. The other one I like on these lines is, it's never too late to do nothing. You see, from now till the time of death, we don't know when the time of death is. The point is, what would one prefer? A thinking mind going on a rampage every day, or a thinking mind disengaged and pure being present? What would we prefer? Accumulating and accumulating and accumulating more and more concepts, more and more objects, more and more opinions, more and more viewpoints, Or till whatever time is allotted to us, living a life of peace, simplicity, harmony, acceptance of what is, and acceptance of thy will be done. Supposing you sat in front of a sage and the sage told you that right now I can just move my hand like this in front of your mind and take away all this unnecessary thinking, all this futile exercise of the thinking mind. In one sweep, I can do this and take it all out and leave you as a complete blank slate, a being of light shining forth. Would not you take that opportunity? Because we know deep down that we are at peace when the thinking mind is absent. And in the working state, when we are focused on the work, on the task at hand, the working mind is engaged, one-pointed, ekagrata. We are at peace. When the surgeon is conducting his operation, bringing forth all his past experience in the moment to conduct the operation in the best possible way, that also is meditation. But when he starts thinking that, my God, this is one of India's leading politicians, and if I make a goof up, I'm in big trouble, my career is going to go. When his thinking mind starts taking him away from the moment, that is the hyperactive thinking mind going into an imaginary future. So, being absorbed in work, whatever it may be, is meditation. Because we are living our lives. That is the living meditation. Just like through the day, being is meditation. And when work is there, there is work. It's as simple as that. There was a man undergoing an operation, and the surgeon told the man, "Relax, David, it's going to be fine. Don't worry." So the man looked very worried. He said, "But I am not David." So the surgeon said, "I know, I am." Mm-hmm.